Well, let's press on with Ezekiel. We've looked at the first section, chapters 4 to 24, which are entirely about Jerusalem and the ultimate obliteration of the city, which the Jews didn't believe would happen. But Ezekiel kept saying, it will happen, and when it does, then you will know that I am the Lord. Now we move on to this middle section, which he prophesied when he was 36, 37 years of age. So there's a gap of a few years between the first section and the second. You see, as soon as Jerusalem fell, all the neighboring countries were thrilled to bits. I don't know if you know the origin of the phrase hip, hip, hooray. Hip, H-I-P, are the three initial letters of Jerusalem is fallen. And I'm afraid it was originally an anti-Semitic celebration. Jerusalem has fallen, hip, hip, hooray. And I'm afraid that spoiled that for me. I can't say it now because that's its origin. And I'm afraid that's what all the nations around Jerusalem were saying. Hip, hip, hooray, Jerusalem has fallen. We're rid of these Jewish people. And I'm afraid they took advantage of the Babylonian invasion, the Edomites and the Ammonites. They did horrible things to the people who were left. And that explains the bitterness in some of the Psalms. Remember Psalm 137? You know, it comes out of Babylon. We hanged our harps on the willow trees. How shall we sing the songs of Zion in a strange land? They wanted to hear our music in Babylon, but how can we sing when we're away from Jerusalem? May my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth and my right hand lose its cunning. Run, sing the songs of Zion in a strange land. Then it finishes up with this bitter cry. Happy shall he be who dashes your little ones against the stones. And I'm afraid they were taking babies by the ankles and smashing their brains out against the walls of Jerusalem. It's a cry from the heart. Will somebody treat you the way you treated us? And the middle section of Ezekiel's prophecy is all about God paying back these surrounding nations for the exploitation of the fall of Jerusalem. And some of the predictions are incredible in their detail. Let's just take one. It's in these chapters that Ezekiel predicts the downfall of Tyre. Now, Tyre was a fishing port on the eastern coast of the Mediterranean, and half a mile offshore there was an island. But the town of Tyre was on the mainland, and it was a fisherman's town. And Ezekiel predicts that one day Tyre will be raised to the ground and all of this city will be thrown in the sea. And that the place where Tyre stood will be a place for fishermen to dry their nets. That's an extraordinary thing, because no city in the entire history of the world has ever been thrown into the sea. Ever, either before or since. But Tyre was. When Alexander the Great came marching down towards Egypt with his great army, the people of Tyre simply got into their fishing boats and went out to the island half a mile offshore, knowing that Alexander had an army but not a navy. But they didn't realize that Alexander wasn't called the Great for nothing. And when he saw the people on the island thinking they were safe, he just said, throw the town into the sea and build a causeway out to the island. And they took every brick, every stone, every piece of timber and threw it in the sea and made a causeway out to the island, and he went out and dealt with them. And if you look at the map now, Tyre is out on the island, and in fact the sand has silted up against Alexander's causeway so that the coastline is no longer straight with an island offshore. It now goes like that, and Tyre is out here. And if you go to the site of Old Tyre on the mainland, it's bare rock, and there are fishermen's nets to this day spread on the rock. Now that's the one that the chances of that happening are 1 in 75 million. But Ezekiel said that's what would happen. See? Centuries before it did. And he predicts what will happen to Egypt. He predicts what will happen to all those neighbors of Judah. And it always did. There are predictions about Ammon, Moab, and Edom in the east. And if ever you've been to Petra or seen pictures of Petra, you are looking at Mount Seir. Do you realize that Edom is Esau? And it goes way, way back to the old Jacob-Esau thing. just as the Ishmael Isaac is today the Arab Israeli conflict. You need to understand history to understand the Middle East. It mentions Philistia on the west of Judah, Tyre and Sidon on the north, and Egypt on the south. In fact, he boxes the compass in this middle section, and he says, when these things happen to them, then they will know that I am the Lord. Now, that middle section is fairly straightforward, so we don't need to look at it, except that there is one man singled out in that middle section as an example of supreme pride, the king of Tyre. And many people have seen in that chapter about the king of Tyre a picture of Satan's pride. And it's not a coincidence. There is a relationship between the devil and the king of Tyre's sheer pride. The king of Tyre said, I am a god. Pharaoh did much the same, and one of the statements of Pharaoh mentioned here is incredible. The Pharaoh of this time said, I made the Nile. Well, he may have dug some of the irrigation channels, but he said, the Nile is mine, I made it. See, now when man gets to the point of pride where he thinks he's God and that he created everything, that's the ultimate pride, and you can't do that in God's presence and get away with it. God will not stand human pride. It is the ultimate sin to set yourself up as if you're God. It's what Adam and Eve did in the Garden of Eden. They wanted to be like God. Amazing that, when they were already in the image of God, but they wanted to be like God in power and authority and not just in character. Now, I'm going straight through that section because it's very straightforward. There's little to explain. And I'm not doing your Bible study for you in these talks. I want to get you into the Bible. I'm just trying to cope with the difficult bits and give you keys to unlock those. So we move on. Jerusalem is destroyed, 587. And now there is a complete change in Ezekiel's preaching. From pessimism, it changes to optimism. Mind you, this was pretty good news for Judah. But now we have really good news. And we have the return from exile in Babylon. We're going home. Something about that gets you, doesn't it? We're going home. Isn't it awful when you're taken to hospital and your clothes are taken away? You feel, that's it, I'm cut off. And then isn't it great when the doctor says you can go home today? Somehow going home has all of it in it. So let's look now at this good news. Very positive, very optimistic good news. And that is why chapters 33 to 39 are so popular. They're full of good news. Chapter 33, however, is an important chapter. It talks about watchmen. Now, a watchman is someone who stands on the walls of a city, and day and night he's watching the horizon, and his job is to warn the city if any threat comes. And God says to Ezekiel, that's your ministry, really. I've appointed you a watchman. And the cost of being appointed a watchman was this. If a sentry did not spot an enemy coming, then he forfeited his life. That's a capital crime. I heard of a British Army soldier who was on sentry duty at a camp, and he was standing up in the sentry box, and he leaned against it. He went to sleep, and he opened his eyes and realized the commanding officer was standing in front of him. So he closed his eyes. He said, Amen. And his commanding officer said, Good man, carry on. Well, I think he really ought to be given a medal for initiative and for thinking on his feet. But you see, if you're a sentry and you fall asleep, or if you're a sentry and you don't see danger coming, then you forfeit it with your life. And a watchman, God said, if you don't warn my people, then you pay for it with your blood. But if you warn them, there is no more responsibility on you. They pay for it with their blood if they ignore the warning. That's the cost of being a watchman. And one of the best known passages in Ezekiel is where God says, I looked for even one man who would fill the gap. I couldn't find one. But Ezekiel was his man. Ezekiel, of course, was not in Jerusalem. He was away in Babylon. But he was a watchman. And when he saw trouble coming, it was his responsibility to warn the people. And if he didn't, he paid for it with his blood. So, in a sense, he had no choice but to go through this costly ministry. He would be held responsible if he didn't. Well, now, the chapter 34 is all about the good shepherds and the bad shepherds, and says Israel's had bad shepherds, and that covers both prophets, priests, and kings. They were all, in a sense, in the care, or should have been caring for Israel, but didn't. Bad shepherds. And at the end of that chapter, God says, I will be their good shepherd. That's taken up by Jesus again, isn't it? I am the good one. When Jesus says, I am the good shepherd, he's contrasting himself with bad shepherds. If you're the good one, there must be bad ones around. And again, when Jesus talks about the good shepherd in John 10, he's lifting a whole lot straight out of Ezekiel chapter 34. That's the real problem. The Bible never blames the sheep for the state of the flock. And that's a principle that applies to churches too. The shepherds are responsible for the state of the flock, not the sheep. And therefore it was the leaders of Israel who primarily are held responsible for the state of the nation. Chapter 37, to jump a little ahead, dem bones, dem dry bones. Everybody knows about the bones, especially because of all the songs that have been written and sung. But very few go on to the two sticks. And yet those are just as important. Ezekiel was told, get hold of two sticks and then hold them in one hand side by side, which he did. But first of all, God said, write Ephraim on one, which had become the popular name for the northern 10 tribes, and write Judah on the other, the name for the two tribes in the south. Hold them together in your hand, and you will find that they become one stick. Some people think it was a vision. I think it was a straight miracle, rather like Moses' rod. But he held them together, became one stick, and God said, I'm going to make one people again, and I will be their shepherd. That's why Jesus talks about other sheep I have which are not of this flock. I'm going to bring them all together, and there'll be one flock and one shepherd and one fold. It's all out of that chapter 37. Go on to the sticks, remember that. And a few years ago, I had a little vision. I saw two sticks, but they weren't held side by side. There were two sticks held end to end with two hands, and on one was written charismatic, and on the other was written evangelical. I saw them become one in God's hand. That's how my book, Fourth Wave, was born. That's some years ago. And it's taken some years for the book to come to fruition, but it'll be out at the end of this month. There's a little commercial. The two sticks become one in God's hand. In chapter 38, we have a strange prophecy of the future that has never yet been fulfilled. And so here we're on the borderline between present and future. It's about Gog and Magog. And don't ask me what it's all about, because I'm not going to tell you. When it happens, I'll tell you what it means. But those two names are picked up again right at the end of the book of Revelation. And it's obvious that it hasn't been fulfilled yet, that some great conflict is coming out of the north. We don't know where or who. One of those things we'll have to wait and see. But Ezekiel again was looking through the telescope into the distant future. And he never saw this fulfilled, and we've never seen it fulfilled. One day it will be, because there is going to be final conflict before history winds up. Throughout all these chapters, the most interesting refrain that comes again and again and again, altogether 77 times, are two little words. I wonder if you could guess what they are. They've been called the longest sentence in the English language. And many of you have said it. I will. I will. That's the longest sentence in the English language. It's a life sentence. See? Are you with me now? It's part of the marriage service. And you don't say, I feel like it. You say, I will. It is a covenant phrase. And this phrase, I will, comes 77 times in just these chapters. I will bring you home. I will be your God. I will give you good shepherds. I will, I will, I will, I will. Here is God the husband talking to his wayward wife and saying, we're still married and I still keep my side of the covenant. I will, I will, I will. Hope you mark your Bibles. If you do, whenever you see I will, just mark it there. And there's this tremendous sense of God's total commitment to his people after all they've done, and even after he's wiped them out. You see, way back at the beginning at Sinai, when God made his covenant with Israel, he said a very interesting thing. He said, you're going to break this covenant, but I never will. So he says in Deuteronomy, there will be times when I have to throw you out of the land I promised you, but I will always bring you back. And they're back in that land today. But listen, that doesn't mean that they don't have to live right. We don't support Israel unconditionally. She's still accountable to God for righteousness and how she deals with aliens and strangers within her borders. God is God. He could throw them out again, but he would always bring them back. That's his I will. And when God says I will to you, that's precious. I will, I will. And when God brings them back home after throwing them out, then the nations will know that I am the Lord. Because it happens so publicly and everybody knows. They're back. And still the surrounding nations may not like it, but they're back. And God has brought them back. They are still his people. Read Romans 9-11. They may have rejected God, but he hasn't rejected them. God isn't like that. He hates divorce. That comes out so clearly. And now finally, I want to come to the last section, which in a sense is the most difficult to understand. And I'm going to leave you with questions rather than answers. Chapters 40-48 are a quite new kind of prophecy. And they're in the 25th year of his exile. Ezekiel is very careful to date everything he says so we can reconstruct it and fit it in to its historical background. If the Bible gives dates for prophecy, it's very important. It means that you must fit that word into the history to understand it. Some prophecies are timeless, but some prophecies are very timely and need to be fitted in. When he was 50, he was given a vision of the future, entirely centered on a new temple. This is at a much later stage of the exile, much nearer they're going home, and all of it is good, just as the first big section of Ezekiel is all bad, this is all good, and it is to give them hope. That's the most neglected Christian virtue, actually. Now abideth faith, hope, and love, and the most neglected of these is hope. And I hear a lot of preaching about faith and love today, but very little about hope. That's one of the reasons I made the video, The Final Facts. We're losing sight of the future, becoming obsessed with the present. And we are the people of hope, we're the people of tomorrow. And the Bible is full of hope for the future. And Ezekiel was not allowed to finish preaching to the exiles without filling them with hope, with something to look forward to. As certain as they'd been thrown out of the promised land, they would be put back into it. They may have been disciplined, but they have not been destroyed. God will never allow his people Israel to disappear. Heaven and earth may pass away, but Jesus said this race will not pass away. And it hasn't. It's one of the proofs that the God of Israel is real. You can't destroy the Bible, for it's God's book. You can't destroy Jesus because he's God's son. You can't destroy the Jews because they're God's people. See? God has communicated his eternity to whatever he touches. You can't destroy what belongs to God. Now, the most serious loss to the people, and particularly to Ezekiel, he felt it personally, was the loss of the temple, God's house. That seemed to be the end, because they had always thought whatever else may be destroyed, God would never let his own dwelling place on earth be destroyed. Yet it had gone. And that was probably the most devastating thing that happened. And as I've said, they had to meet in synagogues from then on, and still do, because they don't have the temple now either. Now, in chapter 40 to 42, you've got the building of the temple described in incredible detail. The rebuilding is to be given an architectural plan. Now, let's just show you a few things. Here's the architectural plan of the new temple. An architect gave me that, and it is a grand, grand temple. You could actually fit about 13 English cathedrals into that area. I'll give you some idea. It is an enormous plan, most elaborate, all the rooms and the porches. And as far as a modern architect can do, that's a picture of it. Quite different from Solomon's. Far bigger, and Solomon's was big enough. But some rather interesting features. No Holy of Holies. No Ark of the Covenant. No Table of the Showbread. These have been lost, of course, by now. And in chapter 43, he sees the glory come back into the temple. He has a vision of the thing lighting up again. As it did after Solomon completed the temple, they prayed and the glory came in. And they saw the whole thing lit up inside. So bright they had the veil to cover it. It would have blinded people. But the glory came, and Ezekiel had seen the glory depart from the temple. Now he sees the glory come back into it. It's a very exciting chapter. There is an altar and there are sacrifices. But chapter 44 says there's no high priest. Now, that's very significant, because when the Jews did go back from exile, they did have high priests. And when Jesus came, there was a high priest, Caiaphas. Now, in Ezekiel's vision of the future, there's no high priest, and his place is taken by a prince. That's very interesting. The prince occupies that highest of all position, a prince who is a priest. But he is basically the prince, the king. And the only priests in the vision are sons of Zadok, Ezekiel's family. Now, I'm sure that's not just his flesh getting in the way of the vision, but God is saying, got to have the right priests. Chapter 45, the whole land is divided between the tribes, but in quite a different way, in sort of horizontal strips from north to south. Quite a different division. Then there is the restoration of offerings and holy feasts and days, which we saw when we looked at Leviticus, with the exception of Pentecost. There's no Pentecost in the new calendar. Again, I'll leave you to think that through. Then in chapter 47 is that vision of a new river in the Middle East. The only real rivers in the Promised Land, there are two big ones flowing into the Mediterranean from the Judean hills. But there's this amazing river that starts nowhere and finishes nowhere, called the Jordan, running down the deepest crack in the earth's surface, a crack which goes right down through Africa, through Tanzania, right down the Great Rift Valley, is all part of that crack. But the deepest point of the crack and the lowest point on the surface of the earth is Jericho in that crack. And there is the Dead Sea, and the River Jordan flows into it and finishes. And the evaporation of the heat down there, about 1,600 feet below sea level, it is tropical. And the evaporation has caused the salt content to rocket up to about 28%. That's why you can sit on top and read a book. Any of you done that? Great fun. It's very dangerous if you dive in. You stay upside down. You can't get your feet down under you, because your feet are like ping pong balls on the surface. And there it is. Now, I'm telling you all that because here in the vision he sees a new river whose spring source is right under the temple up in Jerusalem. And any source of water that starts there has to flow into the Dead Sea. Jerusalem is surrounded by hills, but there is one opening in those hills to the southwest of the city, and it heads straight down to the Dead Sea. It's the Kidron Valley, mostly dry today. But rain finds its way down that valley to the Dead Sea, but he sees a river going down that valley, and more tributaries joining the river so that it gets deeper and deeper. And a man wading down the river will find himself soon out of his depths and having to swim. He sees a whole new river, and he sees the river entering the Dead Sea in the region of En Gedi, which is halfway down the western bank. It's the place where David hid in the caves from Saul, if ever you go there. And there's a wonderful waterfall and caves around it. And as soon as you see the place, you can see the visual images that are enshrined in the Psalms. And he sees this fresh river freshening the Dead Sea. And he sees the fishermen of Galilee coming down to the Dead Sea to fish. And there are fishermen at En Gedi. And the whole thing becomes alive again. It's no longer the Dead Sea. It's a fresh, live sea where fishermen come, where people can live. The whole vision is a dream, if you like. It's a dream to fill the people with hope. It's going to be different. Going to be different. And then finally we have in the last chapter the gates of the city re-erected and the land at peace and prosperity. Everything wonderful. Now then, the question you're all dying to ask, or maybe you're not. One thing is absolutely certain, this temple has never been built. When they came back, the temple they managed to build was a poor little thing. In fact, one prophet had to go to them and say, "Don't despise the day of small things." It was just a poor little temple that they managed to build when they came back from their exile. And that has never been built. So the question remains, well, when will it be fulfilled? Furthermore, they never got a prince back. When they came back, sorry, I told you Zerubbabel was the high priest. It was Joshua, wasn't it? A man called Joshua. Zerubbabel was the governor, and the high priest was Joshua when they came back. But they never got a prince again. They tried at one stage under the Maccabees to be independent and set up a sort of semi-royal line, but it didn't last. By the time Jesus came, there was no king except for King Herod, an Edomite, a descendant of Esau. And in order to try and butter up the Jews and get on their good side, Herod rebuilt this little temple. He said, "I'll build you a bigger one than that." And Herod could build pretty big buildings. You go to Masada and see his palace. But to try and please the Jews, he said, "You don't want a little temple like that. I will build you one grander than Solomon." And he did. Now, we have no photographs of it, but there is a model of it outside Jerusalem. If you go to Jerusalem, go to the Holy Land model, as it's called. It's in the grounds of the Holy Land Hotel, not far from the Knesset. And you can see the whole city of Jerusalem in the day of Jesus, built in stone. It's fascinating. I'm sure some of you have seen it. And the temple comes up to about your thigh. There's the temple. You can just see the Solomon's porch, and you can see the temple itself with the Holy of Holies and the Holy Place right in there. That's a rather poor photograph of the temple in the model, looking from the Mount of Olives down into the main temple, the two pillars, and then leading through with the veil inside, and so on. And it's worth seeing that. But that again was not built on the plans of Ezekiel's vision. It was Herod's architect idea. It did incorporate some of Solomon's ideas into it, but it was quite different. It was this temple. I mean, a man's height would be the width of my finger here. It was enormous. And it was this temple that was still being built when Jesus came. It wasn't even finished. And the stones of the temple, you can still see some of them in what's called the Wailing Wall. It's now called the Western Wall. If you ask the Jews where the Wailing Wall is now, they will direct you to the income tax office. They've transferred the name, and they call this the Western Wall. The Western Wall is not the wall of the temple. It's only the foundation. It's only the platform that straddles the ridge. It's built on the ridge of a hill, but the artificial platform goes out like that, and it's the edge of one of those walls that you see. And there are stones there 40 feet long by 3 feet high by 3 feet deep that weigh 100 tons. And they were carved without the sound of a hammer or chisel. And if you go under the hill into a big cave right underneath, you find the soft rock from which these huge stones were cut. You can cut them with your fingernail. You can cut them with a penknife. And then you bring the block out, and it oxidizes in the air and goes hard. And that's how they managed to build the temple without ever the sound of a hammer or chisel. It's all cut underground with knives and then brought out and oxidized and built up. Well, it's a magnificent sight, but Jesus said not one stone will be left standing on another. And you say, but the Wailing Wall is still there. Ah, but that's not the temple. He said not one stone of this will be left standing on another. Recently, only recently, archaeologists have found the stones of this temple in a great heap at the southwest corner where they've excavated. And the disciples were amazed. Isn't even finished. Well, it was hardly finished when the Romans pulled the whole thing down in AD 70. And what Jesus predicted came absolutely true. Well, so is it ever going to be built? Well, some people say it's not literal, it's a prophetic vision. And it was not intended to be built, it was just to give them hope. That's one way. Another possibility is that what God wanted them to do was to build that temple, and they just ignored Ezekiel's plans and built their own version, which they thought they could afford. I'm quite sure that God would have financed the big thing if they'd had the faith to do it, but they didn't. So we could say it was what God intended but never was. Another possibility is that it's yet to be built in the future. And there are many Christians are convinced of that, either that it will be rebuilt by the Jewish people before Jesus gets back, or that it will be rebuilt in the millennium. I'm going to have to say, I really don't know. I'm going to wait and see. One thing I'm absolutely sure of is this. I have got God's plan for his dwelling place on earth. That was Ezekiel's plan, inspired by God, yes. But actually, that was God's plan. All right. That was God's plan, you see. And it's a very interesting architect's plan. You should come and study it more closely. But that is God's plan for where he was going to dwell on earth. Perhaps you might see it better if it's that way up. That's God's plan, and that was his temple on earth. And that's where God tabernacled among men. Some of you are still peering at it. It's a bit far for you. You better come nearer and have a look at it. It's a good plan. But you are the temple of God now. And God dwells not in temples made with hands. That's said twice in the New Testament. He dwells in people. We are his temple. Whether Ezekiel's temple will actually ever be built or not, I do not know. So I leave that with you. But it was the dream that kept the hope alive in the exiled people of God, that one day they'd get back and everything would be wonderful. And if all that comes literally true, it'll be marvelous, won't it? But I'm going to wait and see. Being very frank there, we can spend a lot of ink over this and get distracted from being the temple of God today ourselves. So why read Ezekiel? Well, let me just finish the talk by saying it tells us about God. It tells us first that God judges his own people. And we need to remember that. Judgment begins at the house of the Lord. Too many Christians think as soon as you've believed in Jesus, that's judgment finished. Far from it. We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. God judges his own people, and he judges them by higher standard than others. We need to remember that. Secondly, we need to remember that God takes vengeance. We don't need to. Very important that. That if people mistreat us, if people are unkind to us, if they tease us, if they persecute us, if they kill us. We never need to try and pay them back. God will do that. And you can leave it safely in his hands. Just remember that when somebody's treating you badly. Feel sorry for them. Don't feel angry with them. Because God's going to pay them back. So you should feel sorry for them. Pray for those who persecute you. Bless those who curse you. God will deal with them. You don't need to. People will think Christians are soft because of that, but we're not. It's just that we believe in God. Thirdly, God will always restore his people. Just as Israel will never disappear from history, the church will never disappear either. You belong to the people of eternity. There will always be an Israel, there will always be a church. And one day there will be one flock under one shepherd. God's the God who restores his people. And finally, a great deal of what we've looked at in Ezekiel is picked up in the book of Revelation. One of the reasons Christians don't understand the book of Revelation is that they don't know enough about the Old Testament. Revelation quotes the Old Testament 300 times. You've got to know your Old Testament to understand the book of Revelation. It's another apocalyptic book, highly symbolic. But it picks up the symbols of Ezekiel and uses so much out of Ezekiel that if you don't know Ezekiel, you'll just be puzzled by Revelation. And that's an added incentive to Christians to study this amazing prophet. Above all, it gives you a view of God, his omnipotence, his power, his omnipresence, those wheels under the throne, moving any way he wishes, and his omniscience. He sees everything, knows everything. That's the picture of God you get. And you get a tremendous sense of his holiness, and the fact that he has tied his name to a nation, that his name rests in our hands. And therefore, of course, God had to bring them back to vindicate his name. And the one thing you can appeal to is God's name and God's reputation. Moses appealed to God. What would people think about you if you did that, Lord? It's a powerful argument with God. Appeal to his name. And you know, his name is now in your hands and in mine. And we either give God a good name or a bad name. But God will always vindicate himself. In the long term, God's reputation is at stake in his people. That's why he will restore them, because he has to vindicate his name. He mustn't ever let the earth and the nations think that he's finished as God, because his people are finished. That's why they never are finished. And he always restores them. Many may perish meanwhile, but the people will continue, because they're the people of God. The book of Daniel is a mixture of the best known and the least known parts of Scripture, I think. Everybody knows about the lion's den. Most people know about the fiery furnace with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego or something. And then everybody seems to know about Belshazzar's feast, which was the origin of our phrase, the writing on the wall, meaning the judgment that's coming. It's also very easy to understand and very difficult to understand. There are parts of Daniel that are so straightforward, you need no help from me to read them and get the message. There are other parts that are so obscure that people have wrestled with them for years. There's the question of Daniel's 70 weeks. And that's been a happy hunting ground for prophetic students for a long time. There's a lot of the book that is natural and therefore easy to understand. For example, that Daniel was healthier when he kept off red meat and stuck to vegetables and fruit. That's a perfectly natural thing which has become very popular today. There are also a lot of supernatural things that people find very difficult to accept, like the fact that the three men cast into a fiery furnace, heated seven times hotter than usual, and their hair wasn't even singed. And unbelievers say, do you expect me to accept that? A lot of it is familiar, to us, displaced persons far from home. I'm afraid that's only too familiar in our modern world. Refugees. But there's a lot that's unfamiliar to us. And Daniel does pose the question, what is the Bible? Is it a human book or a divine book? Same old issue is there. Now, it's written by humans, about humans, as I've said, and therefore many simply treat the Bible as they treat any other books in any other category, as history or literature or religion. But you really can't treat the Bible like that, because it's also a divine book. It's written by God and about God as well. Or at least it's inspired by God, even if men wrote it. And therefore, things that are impossible to men, but are possible to God, figure in so many books of the Bible that you're faced with this whole question. Because only God can do certain things, and only God can say certain things, assuming there is a God. Only God can do miracles. Only God can suspend natural laws, or interfere with natural processes, or intervene in the overriding laws of cause and effect which govern most events on our earth. Or to put it in a word, only God can do signs and wonders, which is a phrase that comes in this book of Daniel specifically. A wonder, the word comes from a Latin word which means something that's wonderful, something that's amazing. Miris is the Latin word. And that has produced our word miracle, something beyond our comprehension, something amazing. The other thing is that God can only say certain things, and in particular, God can only say things about the future with any authority. Anything man says is a guesstimate. He is speculating, but only God can tell us what's going to happen. And the book of Daniel covers 75 years of Daniel's life, but it covers 440 years of history. And not past history, but future history. In fact, as we get into it, we'll realize that he covers at least 2,400 years of history and sees into the distant future with remarkable accuracy. And that again has puzzled liberal scholars who really can't cope with that. Now, there's been a sea change in people's attitude to miracles and prophecies. They used to be considered as proofs of the inspiration of the Bible. And many apologists for the Christian faith used to say, well, look at the miracles in the Bible and look at the prophecies in the Bible. That's proof that the Bible comes from God. Nowadays, both miracles and prophecies are considered a handicap to proving the truth of the Bible. And it's come to just the opposite. And people say, well, if you'd cut out the miracles and cut out the prophecies, I could really believe the Bible. And instead of helping people to believe it's God's book, it now hinders people in believing it's God's book. That's because we now live in a scientific age. So how do scientific-minded people deal with the miracles and prophecies? Well, the miracles, they treat them as fiction rather than fact, as myths and legends. They may have some historical truth in them, but really should be treated as sagas and not as historical truth. So Daniel in the lion's den is explained away as either the lions had just been fed or that they didn't eat Daniel because most of him was backbone and the rest was grit. In other words, these stories have no historical value but have genuine spiritual and moral value. They put Daniel's backbone into you by reading the story. A kind of Aesop's Fables or Struwwel Peter. That's how many people treat the miracles of the Bible today, as tales with a moral. And they treat the prophecies as record written afterwards rather than revelation written beforehand. And you'll find many Bible commentaries by modern liberal scholars taking the predictions about the future and saying, well, of course, these belong to much later. They've been put back into the book of Daniel after the event. And as we shall see, chapter 11 of Daniel is the most incredible account of a series of events which took place centuries after Daniel. And I'm going to give you a sheet of secular historical record of what happened centuries later, so that you can read it alongside Daniel 11. There are about 200 specific details in Daniel 11, every one of which happened centuries later. And statistically, the coincidence is incredible. It must either have been written by man afterwards, or it was inspired by God beforehand. You've got to make a choice. Now, the many people who want to treat the miracles and prophecies in this humanistic way, funnily enough, many of them want to keep the Bible. I don't know why. I wish they'd be honest and throw the whole lot away, but why do they want to keep it? Well, they say you can keep it for its moral and spiritual values. It's a good book. Cut out the miraculous, but keep the moral part of it, and we'd all be much better off. In other words, live by the Ten Commandments or the Sermon on the Mount, but forget the miracles and forget the prophecies. An awful lot of people think that way. Or, unfortunately, many today dismiss the Bible as misleading and irrelevant, that historically it's a book of lies, and you mustn't therefore be taken in by it. So we get this very ambivalent attitude. Do you know why people are unwilling to accept the miraculous and the prophetic? Because they are unwilling to accept God. I really believe that's the basic reason. They don't want the supernatural side of Scripture, because if they believed it, then they would have to live differently. God is only too real. And they would have to come to terms with that and relate to Him. It's interesting, you know, the evidence for the resurrection is so strong, as I've said in my little book on the resurrection, it's so strong that any jury in any court would be totally convinced that it had happened as an event. The events of the evidence of the eyewitness testimony plus the circumstantial evidence that points to it is so strong. It's about 200 times stronger than for the fact that Julius Caesar invaded England in 55 BC. And yet I've never met anybody who questions that Julius Caesar invaded England. They all accept that on far less evidence. Why? Well, because if Jesus rose from the dead, they've got to change their lives. His claims for himself must be true, and therefore his claims on us must also be valid. And you can't ignore Jesus. You can ignore Julius Caesar. You can believe in him without doing anything, but you can't believe in Jesus Christ without changing a whole way of life. There's a built-in reluctance to accept the supernatural dimension of Scripture. It's not just a scientism that believes that we live in a closed universe and that there is no reality other than can be put in a test tube or investigated with instruments. It is largely due to man's reluctance to face the supernatural. Now then, Daniel's book, the first thing that strikes you is that it's in two halves, and that the first half is all miracle and the second half is all prophecy. So we've got a problem. And those who have difficulty with the supernatural really don't know what to do with the book of Daniel. It is the worst book for them in the Bible. So that we have chapters 1 to 6, which are very, very easy to understand and easy to teach in Sunday school, and that's why we know the first 6 chapters backwards, and we've heard the stories ever since we were so high, and why the second half is so difficult, and one that we don't know so well, and is very puzzling when we read it. So let's just, I should have done this in a chart, but let's do it mentally, and you can write it down. Chapters 1 to 6, chapters 7 to 12. Let's draw a contrast. Chapters 1 to 6 is mainly miracles. Chapters 7 to 12 is mainly prophecies. Chapters 1 to 6, the first half, is written in the third person. Daniel, he. Chapters 7 to 12 are all written in the first person, I, written by Daniel himself. So the first half is about him, and the second half is by him. The first half is what happened during Daniel's life. The second half is what will happen after Daniel's life. And some of it has happened and some of it is yet to happen. But it's all future. So first half is present, second half is future. The most unusual difference between the two, now you'll have to listen carefully to this. You see, we've got two equal halves of six chapters each. In the first six, the first chapter is in Hebrew, and the next five are in Aramaic, which is the official lingua franca of the time. It was a language that was used everywhere in the ancient world. In the second half, the first chapter is in Aramaic, and the other five are in Hebrew again. How do you follow that? It's interesting. It tells you where the chapters were meant to be read, who they were directed towards. So that first chapter is Hebrew, then the next five are Aramaic, then in the second half the first is Aramaic and the rest are in Hebrew. So you can tell which parts were meant to be read widely by unbelievers and which were meant for the people of God to understand. Follow? But it's not just two equal halves, it's more complex than that. Now, let's look at the historical background. Put those back up in a moment. No, I'm leaving them in the way. Let's look at the historical background for a moment. Babylon and back. It's very important to realize that the children of Israel weren't all taken into exile together, and they weren't brought back together. That's an oversimplification. When you read the records carefully, they were taken to Babylon in three lots. And they came back in three lots. But actually the total number who came back was very, very much smaller than the total who went. And in fact, they left behind them in Babylon a whole Jewish community, which was there until only a few years ago. So that they didn't all come back, not by a long way. And the wise men who followed the star to Bethlehem almost certainly came from the Jewish community that had been left behind, who were looking for the sign of the King of the Jews. So they were not probably Gentiles, as the usual Christmas story makes out. They probably came from Babylon, from the Jewish community. That's just an aside. Now, the three deportations, you remember the first in 606 was the top layer of society, the key people, and among them they took the young people, particularly the youth. And among them were four young men, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Outstanding young men who were being groomed for the Jewish royal house. And those four men are the heroes in our book. So Daniel went with the first lot among those young people. The second deportation in 597 took Ezekiel. So he followed Daniel. He was a bit younger than Daniel. He followed him. And the rest were all taken in 586. And that's when the city and the temple were destroyed. Now, you don't need to remember all this, but it's just, we tend to get the impression that all the nation went into exile and all the nation came back, don't we? And that's not actually the case. But Daniel was one of the first, and he never came back. Never saw his land again. And he was only a teenager when he went. When they came back later, the book of Daniel is set against the background of going to Babylon and coming back from Babylon. It's all there. Daniel never came back. He stayed and he died there. He could have come back in any of the three returns, but he didn't. The first return was in 536 under Zerubbabel, and it was made possible because Babylon was defeated by the Persians in 539. And Cyrus, the ruler of the Persians, allowed that return, and some 50,000 came back in the first wave. The first Aliyah, as they call it, that is a Hebrew word for going up to Jerusalem. They still talk about making your Aliyah. And the first Aliyah, 50,000, was under Zerubbabel. The second came a few years later, under Ezra, in 458. And the temple had begun to be rebuilt in 516, but it languished for a long time. And finally, the last great wave of Aliyah from Babylon was 445 or 444. It's a little difficult working out the calendar. Under Nehemiah, and that's when the city walls were rebuilt and the city of God made secure from its enemies around. The other one thing I want to point out on this historical background is Esther comes in here, and she was in Susa, which was the capital of the Medo-Persians. And we're going to study her next. But we're concerned at the moment with Daniel, who lived through all this, was taken there in the first deportation and stayed even after the last return. He had a long lifespan, and interestingly enough, he was popular under various successive conquerors. They all recognized Daniel's quality. And as each empire was defeated by someone else, they kept Daniel on because he was such a good guy. It's an amazing career, and the quality of the man just shines through. So that's the historical background. The main emperor of Babylon, of course, who did all this was Nebuchadnezzar. And if you've ever seen the operetta Nabucco, have you? That's a magnificent portrayal of these events in Babylon. Right, that gives you the historical background. Now, Daniel's life, which is covered by chapters 1 to 6 of his book. Chapter 1 is about his deportation in 606, and his selection for the royal court of Babylon. It's very interesting that he was given a Babylonian name after a Babylonian god. He was called Belteshazzar. And so were his three companions. And they didn't object to that. I find that interesting. They're quite happy to be called anything they liked. But they remained faithful to their god. And the crisis arose because they were being fed to be nice and fat. And that was considered good in that court, as it is today in Tonga. If you've ever seen the royal family of Tonga, you know that certain royal courts consider that a sign of prosperity. And so they were being fattened up for senior positions. And Daniel and his three friends did not accept that. And the man in charge of their training at the University of Babylon, they were being given all the wisdom of Babylon, they were being given every educational advantage. He said, look, the emperor will have my head off if I don't fatten you up properly. And Daniel made a bargain with that man. He said, look, we'll go on diet for 10 days and we'll eat what God tells us, and then you can compare us with the other students. And if we are not fitter and healthier, then we'll go on to your diet. Very interesting. How Daniel began his stand for principle in a very small matter of diet. That's the Daniel who could face the lions later. And there's a profound lesson here, that if you can stand your ground over a little issue, you're likely to stand your ground over a big issue. I once said to a saint of God, I'm not sure that I would go to the lions for Jesus if it really came to the push. I don't know if I've got martyr stuff in me. And I'll never forget what he said. He said, David, if you're faithful in little things, God will give you grace when the big test comes. And you'll be all right. And here's the profound lesson. You form your character in small decisions on little issues. And that enables you later, when the big crunch comes, not to shift. It's people who are shifty on little things who fall when the big test of character comes. It's the kind of lesson you can learn from Daniel. And they were not only better in health, it says they were 10 times better in their studies than the other students. I would to God that every Christian student in university was like that. See? They're sometimes too busy in the Christian Union. But if they're in the will of God in being at university, then the best thing they can do for the Lord is to be good at their studies and be better than everybody else at their studies. Do you see? That's Daniel. This is a young man with real character, and he's laying a foundation for a lifetime of service outside the people of God. He's going to be in what some would call a secular job, Actually, there's no job secular to a person who belongs to God. Everything is a sacred vocation. That's chapter one. Chapter two begins the rather mysterious part of the book with a dream of a monster. And that's the only part in the first six chapters that puzzles people, because it begins the apocalyptic part, the visionary, the symbolic part. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and he sends for all his wise men, and he says, I want you to tell me the meaning of the dream, but I've forgotten the dream. And he says, off with your heads if you don't tell me not only the meaning of the dream, but what the dream was all about, because I've forgotten it. Now, there's a real test, isn't there? And Daniel and his three young men could not only interpret the dream, they could recount it. And they told him what he dreamt. Yeah, that's what I dreamt. And they told him the meaning too. Wisdom from God was needed, because how do you know what another guy's dreamt about when he can't remember? God knew. God knows everything. And the dream was of a monster, a giant. And as you go down the giant, so the quality of the material declines, from gold to silver to iron to feet of clay. Have you heard that phrase? Feet of clay, or feet of iron mixed with clay. And the interpretation of the dream is that this golden head is Nebuchadnezzar. But this whole figure is an unveiling, an apocalyptic unveiling of future empires that will replace Babylon. Babylon will be replaced by the Medes and the Persians under Cyrus and Darius. And that happened. But they were not the same grandeur or glory as Babylon. Nothing has touched Babylon since for sheer magnificence. They would be followed by the Greek Empire under Alexander the Great, who would obliterate the Persians and the Medes. Alexander the Great got as far as India. He built his capital Persepolis right where the Medo-Persians had been. And the ruins of it you can see today. And the Greeks would be replaced with the Romans, legs of iron. And really, what a symbol of Rome that is. It was their armies that established Roman law and order. They would be followed by feet of mixed clay and iron. Now, I'll come back to all this later, because we've got somehow to fit all this in. And then he saw a stone taken from a mountain, a stone that was not shaped by man. No, I'm rushing ahead to chapter 7. I think I'll leave it till chapter 7. That was the dream and the interpretation. It's the only part of the first six chapters that is a bit puzzling. It was God's first warning to Nebuchadnezzar, I'm in charge of kingdoms. The whole of Daniel is saying, it is God who causes kingdoms to rise and to fall. Kingdoms come and kingdoms go, but it's God who decides when they come and when they go. And history is his story. And God is saying, I will bring these other empires after you. They won't have your magnificence. They will gradually become weaker, humanly speaking, but it's I who do it. In other words, God is saying, mine is the kingdom, not yours. Chapter 3 is the famous story of the fiery furnace. Nebuchadnezzar, probably because of this dream, ordered a gigantic statue to be erected 90 feet high and 9 feet wide and covered in gold. Now, when you know that the land of Mesopotamia is as flat as a pancake as far as the eye can see, a statue 90 feet high is pretty impressive. It would dominate the landscape. And he made an order that whenever the band played, everybody had to bow down to this idol. It was a kind of established state religion. And it was a quick way of uniting the empire around one religion. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to. I've always wondered, where was Daniel right now? Why didn't he get caught up in this? But they refused to bow down. And Nebuchadnezzar didn't notice, but I'm afraid somebody told tales on them. And you know the story. They were thrown into the fiery furnace, which was heated 7 times more than usual. And when Nebuchadnezzar, by the way, the people who heated it up and threw them in, they got burned up. It was so hot. But when Nebuchadnezzar peered in through the open mouth of the furnace, he saw 4 people in there. And he said, one is like a son of the gods. That's a literal translation. That's as far as he could interpret it. One is like a son of the gods. And actually, the fire burnt the ropes off them, but didn't singe their hair. You can believe it if God is real. You couldn't believe it if you don't believe in God, I don't think. But anti-Semitism became a feature of the Babylonian Empire. And it's been the curse all around the world ever since. Chapter 4 is my favorite story in the Old Testament. That must mean I'm a bit perverted, but it's about Nebuchadnezzar's madness. And he calls it a sign and wonder. And he was converted to the God of Israel. It's an amazing story. I'll just give you the background to give you a bit of human interest. He married a queen, a very beautiful princess, from up in the mountains of Persia, where Tehran now is. And Tehran is surrounded by forests and mountains. And when she came to the palace of Nebuchadnezzar, she was terribly homesick. I mean, she missed the mountains, she missed the trees, and she missed the wild animals. And she kept crying herself to sleep at night. He said, what's the matter? She said, I'm homesick. Well, what have you not got here that you had back home? Well, we had mountains and trees and wild animals. And he said, right, we'll soon sort that out. He said, I'll build you a mountain here. And he built a mountain of brick, a huge mountain of brick. And then he covered it with trees and shrubs and plants. It became one of the 7 wonders of the world. Tourists flocked to see the hanging gardens of Babylon. And then on the top he put a zoo, a private zoo, and cages with wild animals in. Right, he said, no more crying in the palace. You've got a mountain, you've got a forest, you've got animals. What more do you want? Stop crying. So that was basically the human situation behind this story. And then one day, he's on the roof of his magnificent palace. Oh, I better show you what Babylon looked like in those days. I mean, it really was an enormous city. There it is, stretching as far as the eye can see. And here is the royal compound. And then there was a main thoroughfare. There's Nebuchadnezzar in his chariot with his soldiers marching in through a very famous gate called the Ishtar Gate. Ishtar, Ashtati, the goddess, all there. And that Ishtar Gate, well, you better see it. I mean, it was magnificent. Blue glazed tiles, that is the actual gate rebuilt in a museum. And enormous gate. And in these glazed tiles are these griffins and weird and wonderful animals. And I'm sure they lie behind Daniel's visions of animals, as we shall see later, all kinds of animals. By the way, that is the rebuilt arch in Babylon, rebuilt by Saddam Hussein, half size. So you can tell, that's the size of people today, that's the new arch that Saddam Hussein has built, but it's half the height of that. So that's Babylon. And the king was walking on the roof of his palace, and he said, is not this great Babylon which I have built by my power for my glory? Mine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory. And that's when he had a dream. The dream was of a huge tree that reached the sky, and the animals found shelter under it, and the birds in it, in its branches. And the tree was cut down and bound in iron. And then it began to grow again. And Daniel told him the dream, Nebuchadnezzar, that's you, that tree. And you're going to be driven out from among men for 7 years until you acknowledge that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men and gives them to anyone he wishes. And you know, he forgot all about that. 1 year later, God spoke and said, Nebuchadnezzar, what I told you is going to happen now. And he went absolutely crazy for 7 years. They had to lock him up in his own zoo. And he ate grass for 7 years, and his hair grew like the feathers of an eagle, and his nails like the claws of a bird, just like Howard Hughes in his last days, if you saw pictures of that man. And that's what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 7 years, he lifted his eyes to heaven, and he said, God, you're God. And God restored him to his throne, made him greater than before. And then he made a big mistake. He decided to establish the God of Israel. Told everybody they had to bow down to him. And forced everybody to worship this God. You don't get worship that way. But nevertheless, that was his conversion. And forever afterwards, he worshipped the God of Israel, who'd driven him mad. He said, God had to make me mad for 7 years before I came to my senses. It's a hard way to get converted. But what a story. What a story. Great Babylon. And young Daniel there, you see him living in that palace compound, can't you? Chapter 5 is the story of the end of Babylon. Belshazzar has a big feast, and he makes a big mistake. He says, I know, he said, he wanted to profane holy things. Do you remember that in Leviticus? So he said, let's get the holy vessels that we brought from the temple in Jerusalem, and let's use them for an orgy. And that's what he did. They were getting drunk out of the holy vessels from the temple in Jerusalem. And he saw a finger writing on a wall. Many, many tackle up Harsin. You know, what does that mean? When they saw this disembodied finger writing this, they were scared stiff. And Daniel said, that means you are weighed in the balances and you are found wanting. That very night, the Persians got into Babylon. And Babylon was finished. You realize that Babylon was the Tower of Babel? That's where Babel was, same word. It's where they built the Tower of Babel. They were always building big things up to the sky because it was so flat. Big things reaching up to the heaven were so impressive. Babel, Babylon. Well, Babylon pops up again in the last book in the Bible, as you know. Chapter 6, of course, is Daniel in the lion's den. We're now under another king, another empire, another emperor. We're under Darius. And now, once again, there are problems. There's anti-Semitism once again. People are forced to worship the God the emperor wants them to, and people are forbidden to pray to any other God for a period of a month. But Daniel's not going to be deterred. And he always had a habit of praying towards Jerusalem with an open window, looking far to the west, to where God's dwelling place had been. And he went up to his bedroom window as usual. You know the rest of the story. And it says an angel shut the lion's mouths. Takes an angel to hold a lion's mouth shut. And he was delivered again. And Darius had to swallow his words. Daniel just went on and on and on, no matter who came, conquered. Daniel was a man whose quality and whose integrity everybody recognized and therefore wanted to make responsible and give high office to. It's a wonderful model and example for young men, to be the kind of young man whom unbelievers, pagans, will use because they recognize integrity and quality of character. Well, that's just the first 6 chapters, and we'll make a break there.